and answers, and I appreciate everybody holding your questions till the end. So we'll open up the floor for questions now for any and all of our speakers. And I will, in the back there in the green.
Question for Joseph Calabrese. Good presentation. Was there an effort to maintain and or include affordable housing in the Euclid corridor?
I think the table mics are operating.
I think we worked with the city. We worked very closely with the three CDCs along the corridor very closely. I won't say there was an effort to maintain affordable housing. I think there is affordable housing. That affordable housing has grown and expanded as we built. Several major new projects along Euclid Avenue. Some of those are affordable subsidized housing. Some are senior citizen-oriented housing. So I think I don't think we moved anyone out of the corridor, which may be, you know, the purpose of your question. So it really has enhanced what was there. The Cleveland Clinic, I mentioned before, the major employer, they offer incentives for their employees because they're interested in improving the neighborhood around their institution as well. So they do offer incentives to their employees to live close to their campus, which I think is has certainly helped in terms of, paying the closing costs, $15,000 toward the home. The city has a 15-year program, no property tax for the first 15 years if you build in that quarter. So a lot of things have helped to, really, I think, enhance what was there, but really to maintain affordable housing.
And I'm interested in, and you mentioned the fact that you were looking for a tenant that had the right capitalization that would have staying power. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little more about that, because I know it is a challenge to get retail tenants to come in, and how were you able to do it, and what do you think are the keys to success in that? Thanks.
We did it very carefully. both at the Morristown Station project at the train, and then we have a major redevelopment right on the green in Morristown, which has another 65,000 feet of retail at that property. We were in the market for a number of years to retail tenants in the retail brokerage community while we were under construction. Coupled with when the market turned in 2008 through 2010, very challenging at best to get the best capitalized, best credit rated tenant to agree to move forward, coupled with the fact that we were also under construction, and that doesn't always sit very well. Now, it sits well in terms of, great, I'm going to get this great new Class A space, but when the market was doing what it was doing and a lot of people weren't continuing to build, it wasn't a very comforting position for a tenant to be saying, yes, I'm going to commit to your job. So we looked at a variety of user types across the properties, and we actually took the position down the street on the green. We turned down, you know, the $60 rent CVS credit rating tenant because we didn't feel that it brought the right amenity to the building. And we took the approach globally in our portfolio that what's the right retail? How do we know our retail is going to be successful? If the retail tenant down the street, the local mom and pop retailer, if his revenues go up, we know that we were a success. So I think it would be one of the few cases where you would see a developer say that our anchor tenant was a restaurant. But what we did at 40 Park, which is right on the green, we used the Harvest Restaurant Group, Root Steakhouse, and that was our first tenant. And we worked diligently to get that tenant in because we felt that that would bring in a certain caliber of customer. And then kind of animate the streetscape and the nightlife by bringing in a really upscale restaurant. And we then coupled that with getting some of the national tenants and the Starbucks and the AT&Ts and the Qdobas who really need a couple of thousand square feet to infill in along the, you know, the prime locations. And then we kind of transitioned into the more regional and local players. the important thing to appreciate is that it's different on a new construction project versus an existing redevelopment because of the obligations with the construction lenders and the financing and the credit ratings. If this was a standalone building that I've owned for years, it's a little bit easier to maneuver a smaller shop, a smaller business, and work with that retailer. When you're building ground up new construction, that credit rating of that tenant becomes so viable because frequently your lender won't approve the tenant. So I think that we really globally we in our portfolio we look at amenity as a retail. We look at retail as an amenity, and we are very committed to finding that right user that we believe will enhance and provide a service to the residents, but will generate additional traffic to the downtown. And that takes time and it takes patience.
Can I get one quick one, just while I got the mic? Joseph Chiamonte, could you tell us the ridership on the M15? I gather it's pretty impressive.
It's about 40,000. And that's just on the SBS. There's also an underlying local route that has about... Oh, we just got some new ridership data. It's about maybe half that, but so combined, it's 60 on that corridor, and that has always been the most heavily traveled route, bus route.
Gary,
okay, hi. Obviously, if you have a road of where there's only like one or two buses an hour, you're not going to have a bus only lane. But it's something like the exclusive bus lane into the Holland Tunnel where you have lots and lots of buses, you could justify having a lane. My question is, and maybe either Joe or Jim could answer, is there any kind of minimum number of buses per hour in a given direction that you need to justify having a bus-only lane?
There might be. I mean, not so much a New York City transit situation. We're running about, during peak hour, sometimes a bus every 4 minutes. So specific to the SBS routes, they're heavily traveled routes with frequent service. So there hasn't been a situation, at least on the routes that we are using, where there would be that few buses that would be a concern if there's not going to be enough buses, if that makes any sense.
Can I help you out with that, Joe?
Sure.
It's not written, and it will not be enforced, but the reality is that
at least in New York City, they look for a minimum of one bus per signal cycle before they put a bus lane.
And again, the bus lanes are run by the city, not by New York City Transit, so they would be making, you know, those rules, so to speak.
My answer to that question would be whatever you can get away with.
Yeah. I mean, like a developer.
you're going to have more buses during the peak commuter hours, which is when you're probably going to have the most demand on that lane as well. So if you have that lane captured for commuter hours, you might as well capture as long as you can. And I think most people are going to try to encourage people to use public transit, not discourage it. So I think it's whatever you can get away with. I know that we have, obviously on the health line, we have bus lanes or exclusive lanes 24/7. On other corridors we have, like here, they're rush hour only or weekday only. So it's whatever you can get away with.
Bob.
Yes, Bob Bezek, Somerset County. So a comment and then a question. I would encourage the NJTPA to add one additional criteria to the screening, and that is reception to land use changes, because in a home rule state like New Jersey, being able to modify zoning or allow more developer flexibility is a critical element of success. My question is, particularly for if anybody has a familiarity with more suburban corridors, about whether or not you've seen the use of what we call a bus overlay zone, again, to encourage development that's more compatible with bus rapid transit, you know, design changes in the placement of the buildings, more pedestrian amenities, lower parking ratios, that sort of thing, as a developer incentive. Well, I guess you haven't. I suggest maybe you start looking. I believe Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, has a couple model ordinances regarding that. So I think it has application here in our region.
Bob, I could speak a little bit to your concern about kind of public. I think you're asking about public perception as far as the study's concerned. In our screening, and we is that if that's what you mean, you know, public acceptance of something, we see that as either a challenge or an opportunity. So we initially started screening for it, and then we realized that because we're doing this as a study and we're studying how to move things forward, we may want to study, we do want to study how to move things forward in a difficult situation. So, or we may want to study how to move things forward in a friendly situation. So when we were balancing the screening, we felt like, okay, a lot of people don't want it, but it would be a good thing. Well, we want to study that. Or a lot of people want it, and it's a good thing, and we want to study how to capitalize on that. So it, we wound up giving those equal weight in a screening.
Yeah, just I'm not talking about public perception.
Okay.
I'm talking about planning boards and elected officials that are more receptive to applying maybe more innovative zoning or land use strategies. And we all know, I mean, there are the Somervilles, the Morristowns of the world,
that as well, and it was the same thing. If there's a challenging situation, we'd like to analyze it, and if there's a more, you know, friendly and approachable situation, we'd like to analyze that as well as to how to best manage those things. But we didn't want to disclude an area based on it being difficult, because then we don't get the interesting guidance that we're looking to develop.
Tony,
a question for Joe Kepler. At the stops along the BRT routes, the method of payment, can you use only the Metro card, or does it take other cards like a credit card or cash?
Right. As I like to explain it, it's like taking the fare machine that's on the bus and moving it to the sidewalk. So everything that you could do on a regular bus, you could do on the sidewalk at the off-board fare collection machine. So it takes Metro cards, coins. There's a separate machine for coin transactions, but no credit cards.
No credit cards.
Which you can't do on the bus now anyway, or you can't pay with dollar bills on the bus. So, but you know what? Single-digit percentages pay by coin. The vast majority use a Metro card.
The Metro card, could that be replenished automatically?
Not at the fare machines, the SBS fare machines. You'd have to go down to a subway station if there was one nearby.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yes,
Hi, I'm Denise Nickel, Middlesex County. It's a question for Deborah. It's a little bit off BRT, but to what extent did sea level rise affect your plan either in past or currently?
Well, pretty much all of our buildings along the waterfront were hit. On average, our elevations run there from about 11 to 12. We've had the properties that we've had, the properties that are under construction right now, which are all permitted and designed and therefore somewhat limited with what we can do. In some instances, we've raised equipment. So we're building, we're putting all of our transformers and switchgear equipment up on pads and we're raising them a foot. In other projects, like in Harrison, we're back at the drawing board trying to reconfigure and redesign. There's a couple of key factors that go into this analysis. The project at Lincoln Harbor, for example, is a great example. That's in the V-zone, so I would have to be at 16 feet for my ground floor elevation. When you've got existing infrastructure and existing roads already in place, between handicap accessibility and maintaining that pedestrian-friendly streetscape, those are some pretty significant challenges. Coupled that with, height restrictions over the helix. If this was, adjacent to a rail line, I would have height restrictions over the tracks. So from a planning perspective, there are engineering obstacles. From a construction perspective, there are hurdles also, because once you start raising your entrances and your ground floors, you kind of run into that maximum threshold height where your building can be considered a high-rise, and then you have to start doing, you know, pressurized systems and all different fire command control centers and adding a lot of cost into the project. Some of the other things that we're just doing from on our existing properties are, if we can relocate equipment, we will. If we can add floodgates, we're looking at doing that. If we can stock up on sandbags, we're doing that. So it really kind of depends on the project. Jersey City has been very proactive in relooking at their master plan as a whole and understanding that there are differences from one property to the next, but how to still integrate that into a master plan community where you can have existing streetscape. But it definitely has its challenges for sure. The reality is that everything is still in such a state of flux. And even on these buildings where I am raising equipment a foot or, you know, 18 inches or whatever I can, I'm still not in compliance. You know, the new maps, I would still not be compliant. So my insurance costs are still going to increase exponentially, and I have yet to learn exactly what that's going to be. But it still becomes an operations issue of how to just better maintain ourselves and better buffer us from potential impacts.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, Darren.
So this off-board paragraph is really cool and interesting. Has anybody thought of doing something really challenging and putting onboard fare collection? Or maybe I should say onboard fare verification. I mean, I can't remember, as years ago when I was an exchange student in Germany, I think you could get on a bus. You wouldn't have to worry about fiddling with the fare machine off the bus. Just see the bus, you get on it, and then you could stamp your ticket or whatever and get it verified. I've seen that down in Water Street on the M15, where somebody gets to the station, there's a bus, and they have to work with the machine. They have to fiddle out and get their thing, and they miss the bus. The bus pulls away. There's nothing more frustrating than that as a patron.
There's another bus soon thereafter. you know, there's a couple things with the fare collection system we're using. The first one is it had to be something that utilized the MetroCard and was integrated with the rest of the system. And we also implemented it on a very short notice. Within 6 months, we had to come from concept to making it work on the street. And it does work. Now, the other thing to think about, too, is, you know, over the next 5 years, we probably will have a completely different fare payment system. So I don't know what it's going to be, but, you know, it won't be what we have now. So there will be changes.
I think certainly the most challenging aspect of our entire project was the fare collection system. I mean, how to give people more options, but how to keep it simple enough so it's quick and easy to use. So major challenges. And I don't think, you know, this whole fare collection industry is not big enough to really garner, I think, a lot of attention from some of the major players. Not big enough here in the U.S. with U.S. compliant units, so it's a challenge.
And one other thing that I try to tell people, you know, we try to compare it to subway service, you know, to the extent that we can. You know, there's often times you're running through the turnstile and that subway pulls away. I mean, it's the same idea.
The problem is here it's more immediate.
Oh, no, it is. It is.
So there's a different
that.
Level of frustration there from our customers. We encourage monthly passes.
But I can claim one for challenging the bus vendors to adapt. So maybe some more you guys can really challenge the industry.
Even that's a challenge. It's, you know, the manufacturers want to build what they've always built,
right.
And they want to build it in quantity. So that's why we had to upfront some money. And you'll have several of the smaller BRT system, like the one in Eugene that's pretty popular, they could only get vehicles by buying off of our options, because for the number they wanted, no one was going to make them for them. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, over here.
As far as the buses in Cleveland, well, what kind of propulsion system are they? Are they standard diesel buses? Are they natural gas? Are they hybrid? What kind of propulsion system?
We chose hybrid electric. Initially, when I received the Cleveland, when Don was doing the design work, we were looking at a dual mode overhead catenary, you know, system. As we're always, you know, there's planning and then there's really getting down and doing something. You know, the doing something is a perpetual state of value engineering. And as we're trying to cut to the budget to meet a lot of criteria, one of the things we looked at is, do we really need the dual mode overhead catenary? As we were burying a host of overhead cables, we were proposing to put up, you know, the overhead catenaries. And a lot of the architects we looked at the renderings, and there was these spaghetti thin, you could barely see, but that's not the way it was going to look. And I was also concerned about the visual pollution. So we saved a boatload of money by doing away with the overhead catenary, doing away with the power substations and the whole energy generation. We went to hybrid electric because it was quiet, it was smooth, it was clean. But on those vehicles, unlike my Prius, on those vehicles, it's a $200,000 option. So you're not doing it to save money. You're doing it for the image and the more rail-like appearance.
You need the engine to drive the electric system. Is it gasoline?
It's a diesel hybrid electric.
Anyone else? Steve, you're in the front.
Great, thanks. Hi, for Mr. Calabrese. How long did it take to get the full funding grant agreement worked through and describe that process? And I forget in your pie chart, was there private investment? I think we all really appreciated hearing about your sponsorship of the line, and if you can talk both pieces, the time and the private investment.
Yeah, it took forever. I vowed never to do it again. I mean, it was a real challenge. The biggest challenge was not the time. The biggest challenge was the rules kept changing. You know, at one point in time, it was going to be 80-20. At one point in time, it was going to be 63-37, then 60-40. And I got a call from the then FDA Administrator, Jenna Dorn, said, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is we're about to move you in the final design, but it's going to be a 50-50 project. And you've got 6 days to get back to me to tell me if there's a project or not. Anyone's gone through the FFGA, it's a process of self-elimination. Okay, they want you to drop out so they don't have to say no. And that's really where I went to the MPO. I'm on, you know, I chair the TAC, and I'm on the MPO board, and, you know, convinced people from five different counties that this was a really valuable, you know, regional initiative. And really, the money we got from the MPO, the CMAC money, really bridged that difference, and we worked with the state to reorient some money, some enhancement money. So we were able to get it done. Out of that initial $200 million, there was no private money. It was all public money. And again, when you look at, we use the term $200 million, that included things that were really outside of our project. The water lines and sewer line replacement was part of that. That's money the city, things the city did, but you know, replaced 100-plus-year-old water and sewer lines as part of our project, so the cost was much less. You know, they dug down, replaced the lines. We rebuilt the backup, did the resurfacing. So doing that stuff in coordination was very, very helpful. You know, we started applying for the FFGA, you know, probably in 2001, 2002. I showed the picture of Secretary Mineta there at the table. And it's not necessarily the great job we did, I'll tell you. It was October 2004. Ohio's a swing state. President Bush needed to do something, and we pushed a political button every chance we got. And if we missed that little window, we might not have had a project. So, you know, you can't be too aggressive in trying to pull every lever you can think of.
Please use the microphone. Thanks.
Okay. My question is for Joe and Joe. I think the primary, one of the key factors that you introduced, like, which was fewer bus stops that, through which you could achieve lower travel times. My question is whether any additional feeder bus system was pushed into service or, you know, was used as a supplement to your rapid transit, bus rapid transit, in order to reduce the, you know, the walking distance, the walking times for the commuters. And because my perception of bus service is that it is more door-to-door service as compared to a rail service. And if you try to implement the same concept as the light rail to the trains, to the bus system, it just foils the whole purpose. Because, you know, it's once again rail service, which is far away from your, you know, from your residence or wherever you're trying to reach. So was that taken into account while
designing? I think we had probably a couple thousand public meetings. I mean, these things don't happen in a vacuum, you know. And one of the concerns we had was we knew we had to eliminate some stops to meet to get the travel time savings we needed. Mm-hmm. And really, which ones were they? And I think it was really a community consensus plan. I think 108 bus stops to 36 stations is what we did. To my unbelievable surprise, have not had one complaint, you know. And again, unlike a rail line, I mean, it all depends on the spacing. When some people look at our BRT system, they say, why'd you put the stops so close together? So ours are maybe a little closer, and as you get closer to downtown, to the higher density, they are closer together than they might be out where there's less density, which you'd probably do the same thing on a rail line. So I think over time, and one of the initiatives I've given my planning staff is take route-by-route basis, eliminate 15 to 20% of all of our stops everywhere. Because over time, we've seen, we get a call from an elected official or a councilman, can I have a stop at this corner? We had multiple stops in every block. So I think over time, we've developed more stops than we really needed. So we're eliminating stops. I think it's a great trend. The squeaky wheel, if you eliminate a stop you shouldn't, I think you'll hear about it. The only one major issue we had, that there are, I don't know, 22 churches on Euclid Avenue, tremendous amount of old churches, and meeting with the congregations. And there was one pastor, very, very powerful politically, who said, if you eliminate that stop, my senior citizens can't get to church on Sunday. The walk will be too far. So we may have, maybe you have them in New York and New Jersey, we may have the only Sunday-only stop to get his sign-off. And to my best knowledge, no one has ever used it, but we got a sign-off.
Thank you.
Just real quick, I'll just let you. We had several thousand meetings as well with the community. We have local and limited service routes. So in the case of the select bus service, it replaced a limited stop route. The local service, which makes more stops, still exists on these select bus service routes. So they're serving those intermediate stops.
I think that's important too. So in some BRTs, you might have the BRT overlay to a local. In some cases, the BRT may in our case, it replaced a local. So there is, and the other confusing thing, and maybe because I was new at town, if I wanted the next bus downtown, I never knew where to wait because three bus lines would stop at this corner and three bus lines would stop at the next corner, and I was always at the wrong corner for the next bus. So we said we're going to have less stops, but every vehicle will stop at every corner. So it really became more simpler. If you know, if you want to go downtown, get to that stop and the next vehicle will stop and get you.
I do just want to add that at Port Imperial, we do have a complimentary shuttle service that runs the span of the 2 miles of Port Imperial over to the ferry terminal. So I think that as you look at implementing BRTs in certain areas, when you look at master plan redevelopments, there is a way, and my partners may scold me, but there is a way to work with the developer when you're looking at master plan developments. If there is a critical mass and there is a density of enough properties, those properties can figure out a way to offer that amenity and that service. And when you're putting that onus on, you know, dense properties, there's a way to financially absorb those numbers.
Vivian.
Thank you. Thanks, Deb, because my question is for you, and I'm sorry that I had to step out, but I have seen the presentation before. I guess what I wanted to find out, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot, so I know you'll appreciate it. You talked a lot about that the model that you look for when you're investing and developing around transit and very successful. So it's both, what would it take if we were to, at some point in time in New Jersey, actually institute a bus rapid transit or a rapid transit service, the likes of which you've seen described, especially by the folks from Cleveland? What would it take for you as a developer, as an investor, that you do a high-quality product around the state to actually say, okay, that's that's the next thing. That's the next emerging thing that I think I want to be building near, a part of, et cetera. Because I think one of the things that we hear, or we heard today, is that there we need, as a transportation provider, to be really in tune with what the development community is looking for and will tolerate. And we also need to be in tune with some of the institutional partners and some of the large-scale partners. So I'm just curious, you know, looking at what you've seen and sort of, you know, what we've done already in the state and we intend to do more, what is it going to take for someone like you to say, yeah, that's something I'd want to invest around?
You know, I think it's a great question. I think that developers in general, you know, you give us a map, and if you're in Manhattan, you look at the subway route, and you say, where do I want to be? And if you're in New Jersey, you look at the rail line, and you say, where do I want to be? So I think that if, you know, providing those overlay maps of showing where these routes are will become a great tool. Your question is, how do you get there, and how does that become the valuable tool that the developer is going to look to? You know, providing that analysis and that comparison that demonstrates the cost of implementing a BRT versus a train station, it's probably a pretty compelling comparison. What is it, $8 million a mile a track for a train station? Some extraordinary number. So when I hear...
Close.
Probably a little more than that, but yeah, okay.
When I hear no private investment on your piece, that really excites me.
You're not going to get away that easy in New Jersey,
yeah,
but okay.
I didn't think so. But, you know, listen, I think every developer knows that there's going to be some negotiation with the municipality in terms of, you know, offsite contributions and what does that look like? Is it infrastructure improvement? Is it contributions towards the transportation? Working with the developers and if you're identifying the regions that you want to be in, finding those developers that have a critical mass of residents in that community and working with them and saying, you know, can we do a survey with you? So, you know, I mentioned it before, you know, Roseland and New York Waterway, we do it regularly, but we just issued an updated survey because with everything that's going on, you know, New York Waterway wants to be a little bit more adaptive to what the resident needs are. So it's kind of a chicken and egg scenario, but hearing it from the residents as you know, up front on what they need, is only going to, you're then going to be able to have the data to tell the developer, you heard it from your own people. So I think that's going to be a big piece of the puzzle. And I have to say the branding of BRT is going to be critical because, you know, bus still has a weird mentality. And I think that the branding of this is really going to be critical in being able to implement it.
Tony.
Question of fare collection. Is there any thought down the road to come up with a easy pass type of universal payment system for transit that would be applicable to multiple agencies in the region? For anyone, I guess.
Because in terms of New York City Transit, I'm not sure which way they're going, but then, I mean, they were supposed to have a new fare payment system in place last year. So I don't know how it'll be integrated when it comes.
Because that could also offer certain incentives, you know, like we have for Peak Hour and others, you know, that could facilitate the use of transit.
From the NJ Transit perspective, we're actually making investments now in the vehicles to prepare for the next generation of fare collection. One of the problems in New Jersey is our fare system is zonal. The further you go, the more you pay, unlike New York City, where it's a one fare pays you for the entire trip. So we at NJ Transit are starting with making our bus fleet smart. We're putting GPS and technologies on board within the next year so the bus knows where it is in relation to the route, in relation to its ultimate destination. That will allow us to get into the possibility of an easy pass style fare collection system regionally. Because we're statewide, we want to do it comprehensively. We are demoing a system right now in the Jersey City market of a tap and ride where you have a smart credit card. Basically, you keep it in your pocket, you walk on, the fare box knows you've walked on and deducts the fare from a credit card style of system. So in a one-zone operation in urban environments, it's now actually in demonstration. When we get to the smart bus technology in the next year, I think you're going to begin to see from us the integration of smart technologies and fare collection, not only on buses, but with our other modes as well.
Thank you.
Bob.
How do you overcome this perception of lack of permanency? When we talk to developers, that's one of their concerns about pluses. You know, rail is here, it's going to stay here, but there's this perception that 5 years from now, you know, the bus line isn't going to serve their development, and so there's a reluctance to invest.
I think in Cleveland we did it with the permanence of the stations. I mean, the stations are very substantial. It's really the infrastructure with the exclusive lanes, with the stations in the center median, that it's there. I mean, in almost every case, our stations on the health line are more comprehensive than they are on our light rail line. And no one questions whether, I mean, we can paint like fake tracks on the road, but I don't think there isn't any question of the permanence.
Are there any other questions? All right. Well, seeing none, first I'd like to thank you all for attending.